as we turn to our first scripture, Proverbs.
Proverbs 1, beginning with 7 and then 20 and following. You might note as we follow through wisdom, wisdom is imaged as a woman, and the connotations of that are not necessary as we listen to the words of gathering and listening to God and God's direction. Hear now, Proverbs. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Wisdom cries out in the street, in the square she raises her voice. At the busiest corner she cries out, at the entrance of the city gate she speaks. How long, O simple ones, will you love being simple? How long will scoffers delight in their scoffing, and fools hate knowledge? Give heed to my reproof. I will pour out my thoughts to you. I will make my words known to you, because I have called and you refused, have stretched out my hand and no one heeded. And because you have ignored all my counsel, wouldn't have none of my reproof, I will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when panic strikes you. When panic strikes you like a storm and your calamity comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you, then they will call upon me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but will not find me. Because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord, would have none of my counsel and despised all my reproof. Therefore they shall eat the fruit of their way and be sated in their own devices. For waywardness kills the simple, and the complacency of fools destroys them. But those who listen to me will be secure and will live at ease without dread of disaster. The word of the Lord. As we gather with the gospel in our midst, if it is your wish to stand and greet the gospel by standing, you are welcome to join me. We turn to Mark, the 8th chapter, and we hear the words of the Master Teacher. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they answered him, "John the Baptist, and others, Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." He asked him, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah." And Jesus sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. The word of the Lord. Have you ever heard of politically correct language? Is that a thumbs up or a thumbs down? I heard kind of there was a lot of thumbs down on it. You know, in the 70s when it was first coming out, they were going to replace the word man with peep. A fire peep, a police peep, a chair peep of a committee. It seemed like it might be a solution, but one of the people that work out on the streets says, "Well, what do we do about those things in the road where we have to lift the cover off and climb down in those? Those would become peepholes." Didn't quite pan out there. The true story is, I am told, but that might be apocryphal. Stanley Hauerwas is a theologian of our time, one of an esteemed group, and he made some interesting. He made this statement. I want to read it to you. "You can only act in the world you can see." That's where he begins. "You can only act in the world you can see." Let me give you an example. One of the gals that went on a mission trip that we know before, she traveled to Thailand. And in Thailand, ports of Thailand, I'll pick another spot. In the outbacks of Thailand, there's no electricity, there's no running water, there's no sanitation. Very primitive conditions. But the people each have their own TV sets. They run on battery. It's a DC powered, but you have a car battery. And the car battery will last one night. One night. So she came back and she said, "We need to take an offering to help buy car batteries for the people of Thailand." How many of you would have given to car batteries in Thailand until you realize that this is their connection to the rest of the world? This is their window into everything. They work all day just to get by, and at night they can come for a couple of hours and connected through the gift of television to the world. You can only, how did he phrase it? You can only act in the world you can see. And so that missionary brought back to us that vision of how to be in the world. Hauerwas goes on. You can only act in the world you can see. And you can only see by learning to say. You can only see by learning to say. Now, I don't know Hauerwas personally, but I think what he's talking about is one of those phenomena. Psychologists, how many of you remember the day you were born? Now, come on, that's a pretty formative event. Don't you think that we would remember something as, who was it, Charlton Heston remembered? He said he remembered being born. He remembered being in the womb. That's okay, but most of us somehow don't remember that formative event. What? How can that be true? I mean, psychologists say, well, you really probably don't remember anything before you begin to learn language. Because language is the framework around which we put the experiences that we've experienced. Paya, can I pick on you a minute? You're speaking Samoan, Tongan, and English. Which language do you see in? Kind of all of them, don't you? I'm kind of feeling colorblind. With all of the, she's got a broader vision and ability. We knew that, too. I mean, the secretary always runs the church office, so we know how that works. But think about how that, what that means and how that is in the midst. And as we develop language, it's like at a time. Dawn, do you remember when they first begin to write down notes for music? It wasn't early on, right? It was much later, like Middle Ages? Or I'm sorry? He was alive for that? I'll stand over here and let them iron that out. You got a wild bunch there. Yeah, look, he's picking it up. So. But out of our life experiences, we need language to describe it. Let me give you an example. Tell me what a banana tastes like without using banana. Now, there's dietitians that can probably tell you, and there's professional testers that have language to describe that. But now try and describe it to an Eskimo. Never seen or been around a banana. Describe the flavor of a banana. Speaking of Eskimos, have you ever seen snow? Come on, we're Coloradans. You can put, we've seen snow, haven't we? I am told in the Eskimo language, one of their languages, Inuit, that there are 15 words for snow. It's not just snow. There are 15 different words for snow. Can you imagine? Why would there need to be 15 different words? Okay, wait a minute. There's those big flakes, and they come down, and they're beautiful. They're about half the size of a pancake. You know what I'm talking about? And they float down. You know those kind of flakes? They're a lot different than those little tiny ones that they're coming down in the air, and they're so small, and it's almost like a fog. By golly, that's a different kind of snow, isn't it? How about those ones that come down, and they're like a little BB that somebody threw at you? Have you had that? You've experienced that kind of snow? By golly, you know, once I realized that they name 15 different kinds, I begin to pay more attention to snow. It broadened my ability to see the diversity of God's creation in snow. I'm not ready for it yet. Don't go there. So language helps us organize our world. And language is vital on how we establish relationships. And unfortunately, about how we do things about judging stuff. Let's say you're interviewing a candidate to work for your business. And the person has a resume that's just right where you want it to be. All of the right experience, all of the right things, seems to be the right person. And the last question you ask, why do you think you would be a good employee? And the candidate says to you, I think I'd be real good for you guys. Language, and language and the ability makes a huge impact on it. Let me give you another example. How many of you know what a hippie is? Well, here's the first question. In 1940, it was somebody you did not want to sit on an airplane with because the seats are narrow. Hippie. Do you remember when people were hippie? That's what it used to be. I actually remember watching a show, and this woman was particularly hippie. They commented on her being hippie. But that's not the image that came to your minds, was it? No, there was a pretty resounding no there. What image comes to your mind when you think of hippie? What? Long hair and beads. How many of you have on beads and have long hair? See, that's not it. Well, there's a part of it there. I think of Easy Rider. I think of... I forgot it again. Woodstock. Thank you, Paula. I could not come up with that name. Woodstock. How about... You know what's really frightening? Do you remember when Woodstock first happened and the music was in our culture? Now you hear it in elevators. What does that say? What does that mean? How does that all... Something about languages... and changing us. What about young kids today? Have you seen them wearing tie-dye shirts and beads and things that say beetle and peace symbols on the back of their t-shirts? What does hippie mean to them? I don't think it means Easy Rider. I don't think it means any of those things. It has another meaning. It's morphed again. Language. And if we talk to them and they say, well, I think hippies are cool... They wouldn't use that word because cool is an old-fashioned term, isn't it now? But they like hippies, and we have one image, they have another one. All of a sudden, how we see and hear, it's language. Not politically correct language. We're talking now about Christian correct language. Christian, you politically correct, you can take it or leave it. I think the vote from the choir was a negative. But Christian correct language is a different ballgame. How do we interact with one another lovingly, carefully, in consideration of one another? You see, I think that what we read in Proverbs this morning, therefore they shall eat the fruit of their way and be sated with their own devices. The Reverend Brandon Wincher said that we were translating that a little bit wrong. The better translation is, we will eat the fruit of our lips. We will eat the fruit of our lips. We say we have to eat. Does that make sense? It goes back to the sermon of last week, doesn't it? And the last couple of weeks about the tongue and how the tongue guides the mighty ship and how the tongue is untamable and how we need to be Christian correct in our speech and who we are. I have to tell you about a couple. This couple, they lived out in the country, and they had a house that's off the main road. So there's a little drive to get back to the house there. And the trash had to go out once a week. We all do that, right? So that's easy. But it had to go from the house to the road so the trash people would pick it up. They wouldn't come down the drive and get it. So the job was up to the guy. He had a pickup truck. He could set the trash in the back, take it up to the road, and set it off there for the trash people. He got up every morning earlier than his wife, and he left for work. She got up, and the trash was sitting there at the house. Well, she hauled it up to the road in her car as best she could, and by the time he got home, she was pretty angry. And she looked at him and she said, "You forgot to take out the trash this morning." Well, you walk right in the door and get hit with that. He was a little bit put off by it, and he said, "No, I didn't." Well, they hadn't talked really in a week. They'd been fighting that whole time until they came in to see me. Because they couldn't get past this. They were so angry at each other and communication. Well, it turns out the story is interesting because if you take the trash out early in the morning, he had discovered that the wind would knock it over and it would get scattered and he'd have to clean it up. Or critters would get in it. He discovered that the trash people came right after lunch and he came home for lunch. He was going to take it out at lunch, so it wasn't out there so long. So no, he had not forgotten to take out. Nonetheless, she had had to take the trash. The problem is in how communicate. Sometimes in how we communicate, and sometimes in how the communication systems work. We're going to go up here. In language stuff, we call that a you statement. Whenever you say, you did this or you did that or whatever, generally speaking, you're tossing kerosene on a burning fire. How will that work? Anybody have any experience with that? It's just not really where we want to go at all, is it? So the you statement is also a judgment. You forgot. He has been tried, convicted, and he's about to get the execution. And that's what kind of sets him off, because now he has no rebuttal, really, because it's all over. He's in trouble. So he responds knowing full well that it's not a complete statement, that no, he hasn't forgotten. How could she have said it differently? How could she have expressed her emotional mood, which was not very happy, and what was happening without using a you statement? Anybody any good at this? Now, I do this with premarital counseling and with couples all the time, and that same response is generally what I get. There's dead silence, and they're thinking, I don't know. But we need to learn how to communicate differently and not use statements that throw kerosene on a fire. How would you say it differently? Help me out now. Please, Carol. Okay. That's better, but you still got the you in the end, didn't you? How about it was really hard for me to take out the trash because I don't have a truck? And I'm kind of upset. Now, if you were a guy and your wife had said that to you, would you say something differently and not be quite so inflamed? I think so, because it's no longer a judgment. And then you would have said, you know, I'm sorry, I should have told you that I'd be here at noon to take it out. And then there could have been a romantic moment, and there would have been this loving and hugging and kissing, instead of this fight that went on for a week. So we are the fruit of our own mouths. What we say goes out there. And you statements are a toughie. I want you to work with that. I'm serious. Think about if you use you statements in life. And think about how to say things differently. You all were sitting here thinking, I don't know how to say that differently. Because it demands of us a change of how we think and how we are in the world. You see, we're Americans. And we like to have judgment, and we like to have penalties, and we like to see justice done instantly. In this modern television age, we can see it and we can get there. So when something awful happens in the news, we want conviction and we want punishment within the next 30 seconds. We're ready, aren't we? That's kind of how we are. People are like that. We're ready for instant vengeance, instant response. Gesundheit. In German, das ist verboten. This is forbidden. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. Vengeance belongs to God. We have seen instances in our society of people that we believe in our hearts that they are guilty. We know they've done awful things, and they don't seem to get the punishment we'd like to see. The vengeance, that visceral feeling of getting their due reward, just doesn't seem to be there. But think a moment, if we are God's people, that they will stand before the Lord. That they will stand and that judgment will be there. And this judge can't be swayed, and this judge can't be talked in or out of. There are no technicalities you can pull on truth and justice. So we can leave vengeance to God. Dang, that changes a lot of things about how we are, doesn't it? I'm the worst in the car. I can tell you everything that every other driver is doing wrong in a car. And of course, I'm a perfect driver. Don't ask Paula when she's riding with me. She might not agree. But we're all like that, aren't we? We're all kind of about us and those others. And how do we rethink and reimage that? Reimage and say, this other person is also a child of God. This other person also might be distracted like I was back at that other intersection and almost missed that light. Vengeance is mine. Jesus turned it all on its head with the woman caught in adultery. She was guilty. Didn't argue that. Nobody argued that. And the law was straightforward. The Pharisees loved having that ability. Here's the law. It's black and white. Let's exact judgment. And he didn't say no. He didn't say anything about that. He didn't tell them they were wrong. He simply said, those of you who are without sin, cast the first stone. That speaks to us today. I do that repeatedly. I saw somebody doing something driving-wise, and I thought, they're not paying attention to their driving. And I thought, that was like me yesterday when I was distracted and the phone was ringing and I was... So we need to rethink how we are and what language we use and where we're in the midst of that. They asked Jesus, he asked them, he says, who do people say that I am? A teacher, a prophet, John the Baptist, Elijah? You remember Elijah, he never died. And in the Hebrews' understanding of text and a Bible, Elijah has been whisked to heaven and will return. Can return still alive, this great human prophet. And so they're envisioning the Messiah as their coming back of Elijah, or maybe King David. The great King David was a great, wonderful human king. And so that's as far as they can think about this coming of another great choice of God. And Simon Peter says, you are the Messiah, and understands that that is a word beyond what they understood then. It's a new word about a whole new concept. It's a word that describes not a human being that has great abilities. And it's a word that says this is God with humanity. This is Creator with creation. Messiah. It's a word that we use now kind of without thinking about. And maybe we need to back our language up and understand that in Christ's language, this is a big word and a central word to who we are. Political correctness, you can do as you like, as long as it's loving, caring. And you would say it to someone you loved more than anyone else in the world. I think you're probably all right to speak. Christ's conversation is that. Love one another. As I, the Creator, have loved you, the creation.